Yes, we'll see. There are people who've done lots of work on this in this room. Okay. So thanks, Matt. I'm going to talk about vacuum bubbles, as it says. Okay. And I'll get to exactly what I'm doing that's new in this problem. Okay. And anyone who knows Dick knows, okay. Hopefully 13, 12 for these three papers, but they're in his hands right now, so we'll see about that. Okay. So just a quick outline of what I'm going to talk about. So first of all, I'm just going to give a really, really quick overview of the whole bubble picture and the usual framework that people use to study this problem. And then after that, I'll talk a little bit about how we set initial conditions for this problem. So again, it's just basically a wave equation, so you need to set your initial state. And then after that, this is the main part of the talk, is doing full 3D dynamics for these things. And I'll talk about what this means when I get to it. Okay, and I'm going to consider a few different types of potentials to study bubble collisions in. And then after that, you can sort of get fairly far into understanding what's happening just by doing linear fluctuation analysis. So I'll do a little bit of that. And then some really wild speculations about implications for this to observations. Okay. All right. So just a really, really quick review. So suppose you have a universe and there's a scalar field, and the scalar field has multiple minima, okay? So the simplest thing you could probably write down is something that's like a double well. Now you'd imagine that the universe is somehow stuck over in this well. Or in the context of eternal inflation on the landscape or something like that, you might have a much more complicated potential with lots of little minima. And then you can imagine that you get stuck in a local minimum. Okay. Now classically you're stuck there and you can't go anywhere. But quantum mechanics, of course, lets you tunnel from one minimum into the other. Okay. And so though there's some decay rate for this per unit pore volume, which has a bunch of things in it that can vary by several orders of magnitude depending on exactly what your model is. And then, of course, if you can nucleate one bubble, you can nucleate two bubbles, and three, and four, and five. And eventually these bubbles will expand and then hit each other at some point. Okay. And so the question I am going to ask is, there are lots of other problems you can deal with, such as what's the probability that you have a certain number of collisions? If you're living inside one of these bubbles, what's the probability that you see a collision? Okay. I'm not going to worry about that. I'm just going to ask, suppose I take two bubbles and I let them collide. What does the dynamics for that collision look like? Okay. And so there's been lots and lots and lots of work on this topic. Okay. And so PI has a non-negligible amount of work in this area as well, so the bolded people are people here. So you can talk about, first of all, just what do individual bubbles look like. Then you can start talking about collisions. And as far as I know, there's only been one calculation that was done in 3D, basically. Except I do want to point out that they used very symmetric initial conditions. Okay. And there's this actually very nice set of two papers where general relativity is included in this. And people have also looked for these things in data. Okay. Now, the only thing I want to point out is that all of these papers make certain assumptions about the symmetries of the field configurations. Okay. And it's never really been tested very well whether or not those symmetry assumptions are actually going to hold in. Okay. So the approach I'm going to take is to do a lattice simulation. Okay. So I wrote my own lattice code, and now I can use it for whatever I want. So for this problem, we're just going to solve this equation, okay? And at this point, I have essentially arbitrary accuracy for the time integration and also arbitrary accuracy for the spatial discretization. And there are a couple of other options that you can do. The important thing for this, the stuff I'm going to talk about here, is that we can get energy conserved to like the 10 to the negative 9 to 10 to the negative 14 level in a full 3D simulation. So, okay, so if I were to set A equal to 1, okay. If you want to self-consistently evolve A, which you could do with the bubbles, it turns out to not be very well behaved. Okay. If you were self-consistently evolving it, it would mean what's the constraint equation? So H squared equals rho over 3. So before I go to what I've been doing, okay, there is a very standard framework for doing this problem. And it assumes that the two-bubble collision geometry has an SO2-1 symmetry. And so where this comes from is that the most likely bubble that you're supposed to nucleate is supposed to have an SO3-1 symmetry. And this just means rotations about the three axes and then boosts in all three directions. Okay. So when you add a second bubble, you can't rotate it this way anymore. You can't rotate it this way anymore, but you can still rotate along the collision axis. So you have one rotational symmetry left, and you break the boosts along the axis connecting the two bubbles. Okay, so that breaks the symmetry of the one bubble down to an SO2-1. Okay, I do want to emphasize this is only the most likely bubble to nucleate. Okay, and so this is very, very useful because you can go to new coordinates, and here I'm just going to work in Minkowski for simplicity. And this symmetry lets you rewrite that horrible, nasty, nonlinear three-dimensional wave equation as a one-dimensional nonlinear wave equation, which is much, much, much easier to deal with and actually lets you make some analytic progress in a lot of cases and also makes numerics much, much easier to deal with. Okay. Of course, so this is really the question I'm going to ask is, should you trust this approximation when you put quantum fluctuations in? Okay. Because those fluctuations, in general, will not obey the SO2-1 symmetry, okay? So more specifically, what I mean, suppose that in general you just nucleated n bubbles, okay, at some positions ri, and then you take sort of the dilute instanton gas approximation where the bubbles are all well separated, then you're going to have sort of the zeroth order solution, which is this stuff, okay? But there will be this extra piece that's supposed to be the fluctuations, okay? And so if you want, if you're doing quantum theory, those have to be here, okay? And two very specific reasons why you want them there in this problem are, we said that the bubbles are going to nucleate. If you don't have fluctuations, you can't have nucleation. And this applies to quantum field theory, and it also applies to thermal field theory, okay? So if you want to say we nucleated a bubble, the fluctuations have to be there, or you couldn't have nucleated in the first place. And then again, in the context of eternal inflation, if you want to live inside this bubble, then inflation is supposed to be making all the large-scale density perturbations for you. That only works if you have sub-horizon fluctuations that can be stretched outside the horizon by the inflationary expansion. Okay? And so now we've perturbed our initial conditions a little bit from what is usually done, and you want to know, can this delta phi end up being a dynamically important thing? And it's important to point out that you cannot check this using a 1 plus 1 dimensional simulation. You really do need to go to, not 3D, but at least 2D. Okay.
And the size, will you take the size of delta phi to be arbitrary, or is it sort of?
This is a very good question. So I'm going to take the separation of the bubbles and the amplitude of the fluctuations to be independent. That's not really true. Okay, if you make the fluctuations bigger, you increase the nucleation rate, so the typical separation between the bubbles decreases. Okay, the only reason I'm doing that is because I'm running lattices, so I have a finite box size. And as I'm going to show, these fluctuations can be unstable. So they have to become unstable before the bubbles get to be the size of the box. And so I just basically set the minimum on delta phi so that I still trust my simulation and the effect. But that's just a numerical issue. It's not anything physical that's happening.
So are you going to talk about single bubbles?
Only very, very briefly. So the single bubbles, everything's stable, as far as I can tell. I make no guarantees that that's true in general, but as far as I can tell, that is, they are stable. It's the fact that you have this condition that's really changing. And I have simulations of the single bubble, but they're not in this talk. So if you want, I can show you afterwards. All right. So there are two things we need. So before we start and put this in, first of all, we need to get the initial conditions, OK? And so for that, we have to figure out what the bubble profile looks like. And so to do that, I'm just going to use the bounce formalism from Goldman, OK? And so all I need to do is solve this equation with these boundary values, with these boundary conditions, OK? So this is a two-point boundary value problem. It is, in this area of physics, it's usually solved by a shooting algorithm, okay, combined with a bisection. I found it was very, very difficult to generalize that particular method to multiple fields, and it's basically impossible to generalize it to a PDE, such as you would get with the thermal nucleation of the bubble. So to me, it was much easier to just do a pseudospectral thing, where you expand the solution in some set of basis functions, where these are just going to be Chebyshevs. Okay, and the only two things you should really notice about here, so if I ignored H, the Chebyshev polynomials are defined on negative 1 to 1, so this just maps them to negative infinity to infinity. And I'm only picking the even ones because of this boundary condition. So the zero boundary condition is satisfied automatically when I do that. And this H here is now, as you'll see right away, there's a certain regime where you tend to get boundary layers in the solution, which is the thin wall approximation. And you can basically think of it as there's an interior for the bubble, there's a wall that's not very big, and then there's an exterior. And so if you want this thing to work properly, you have to cluster points around that wall. And so that's all that this transformation is doing. Okay. And so because it's a global expansion method, which is spectral, you can get really, really, really accurate results. Okay.
And what so is D?
D is an arbitrary parameter I'm allowed to tweak. Yeah, so what you should think about it is it's the width of the bubble wall over the radius of the bubble is roughly what it is. And L is essentially going to be wherever the radius of the bubble is. Okay. So you just set them so that you get a good solution, basically. So the other thing is you only really need to start tweaking this when you're in the thin wall case, and then you have a decent analytic solution to start with. So you more or less know what you have to set it to before you start. And so now you can go try this in a bunch of potentials. So up here, I just have a selection of potentials that let you make bubbles in them. Okay. And so here are various types of instantons that you can get. So there's the ones that are like really thick-walled, and they will tunnel out very, very far from this minimum. And then as you start tuning some parameter, you eventually get into this thin-walled regime. And just to show you how good this approach is, so down here, I've taken some really thin-walled bubbles. Okay, so these things basically look like step functions. Okay, so the width is about 1 in units down here. So the width to radius is like 1 over 1,000 or something. I need about 100 mode functions to resolve those to machine precision. Okay, so this part here is just round-off plateau of, this is as precise as double precision numbers are on your computer. This gives you really, really accurate results if you want them. And it generalizes to multiple fields in a very straightforward way. Okay? All right. So now that I've figured out how I need to set my initial conditions, I can actually start doing some collisions of bubbles. Okay. And so first, I'm just going to look at a double well potential.
Sorry, I'm missing the introduction. Are you including gravity as well in this?
Only in the absolutely most naive way. So I can put a homogeneous expansion in. So I will, the time scales I'm looking at are very short. So there are two things gravity can do. You can have the Hubble, which is sort of when you integrate that effect, you have to care about gravity. Okay, so I'm looking at very short time scales, so that will be a small perturbation. Okay. The other thing you could have is the walls hit and you get a singularity. Okay, that's the very strong gravity regime. You can, of course, tune the value of this phi naught here so that it's less than Planck. And then that's not going to be an issue, okay? Yes, or else homogeneous expansion. There's no. So what? Yeah, it would be background to sitter, except you don't have a different H inside the bubble. Is really what? Yes, it is much, much harder to do the full numerical GR problem. Is Oh, sorry, when you're doing 3D. So for the instanton solution, yes, you can generalize it. It's not so bad. But when you do the 3D evolution, it's horrible. Okay. Yes. So this is something that I'm working on right now. There are certain cases where it converges properly, and there are certain cases where it doesn't. And I'm quite sure it's programming error. But yeah, the way I'm doing it will generalize to the case where you have a fully dynamical metric. Just doing a fixed de Sitter is very easy.
Because there are very interesting parameter regimes in the
yes.
which would be interesting to see.
Yes. This is something that I'm thinking about doing now that this is done. But that's not finished yet. It works in some cases. It doesn't work in others. And I'm not exactly sure why that. But it does generalize. So back to what I'm going to do now. Okay, so this is the explicit form of the potential. So you can think of it as something that's the symmetric double well and then a little perturbation to split the degeneracy of the minima. Okay, and so now if I do the usual thing and I assume I have an exactly SO2 2-1 invariant collision, so I just go solve the one-dimensional equations, I get something that looks like this. Okay, so this has been known for a long, long time. It goes back to the Hawking, Moss, and Stewart result, which is essentially this. Okay. So when you look at this, there are a couple of things that should disturb you a little bit about this approximation you've made. So if you're, so remember, first of all, that the field is supposed to be only depend on S. Okay. So when we add the extra dimensions that are not shown in here, the Y and the Z, we have to basically extend this out on a hyperboloids. Okay. And then rotate those hyperboloids. And so if you think about what this is actually showing you is there's these outward propagating waves that are confined to a very small region around where the collision happened. Okay. And so inside these waves, you're sort of close to the false vacuum. Outside, you're in the true vacuum, so there's a pressure differential. Okay. And now if you imagine putting little ripples in those things that are propagating outwards, the pressure differential will tend to amplify those fluctuations. Now, there's a competing effect from the tension and the fact they're expanding. So this doesn't tell you that you will have an instability, but it tells you that you might. And the other thing you should worry about is if you are someone sitting right here, you see an oscillating field. Okay. And so in cosmology, we know that when you end inflation, say, with a homogeneous oscillating field, you can derive very strong parametric instabilities, okay, just because the field is oscillating. And so as I will show, both of these things are actually there in some cases. Yeah?
So that's why I asked you about the single bubble case, because it is known that if I have an expanding and contracting bubble, that is violently unstable.
To when it's contracting. When it's contracting, yes.
Yeah, in the contracting phase.
Yes. Yeah. So I'm only concerned with the expanding case, but yes. If you make a not perfectly spherical bubble, make it collapse.
Oh, but I mean that little.
Oh, sure, yeah.
You might have gotten some intuition from that.
That would be another way to do it. Yeah, this is why I'm saying it's a tube.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. So that was the SO2-1 case. So this first thing you should take is a test of the coat. Okay. So what I'm going to do is just take this exact bound solution that I had, okay, and I'm not going to put any fluctuations in. So the profile is this blue one over here. Okay. And I run it. So the vertical part is a slice along the collision right through the middle of the bubbles. And this plane is then taking a slice right perpendicular to the collision axis right at the location where the bubbles first collide. And so you can see they hit, and you start making these waves that propagate outwards. And again, they're confined to a very narrow region near the collision. And they go out, and they go out, and they go out. And if you look at this, it sort of looks like, okay, these things are just sort of accelerating up to the speed of light. So you might think, okay, this looks pretty symmetric. And you can actually check that.
It doesn't seem like the amplitude is dying out for you. Is that just because it takes longer than
that? So it's a damped oscillating field. So it's just the same reason that a homogeneous oscillating field damps. Okay, so all I've done is taken this slice on the front edge of the bubble here and plotted it versus time. And so if you had an exact SO2-1 invariance, the result would be constant on lines of constant S. So these black lines are lines of constant S. Okay, and if you look at it, it's pretty good. And considering that I'm using a discrete time step and a discrete spatial lattice, which explicitly breaks the boost and the rotation symmetries, that's actually pretty good.
that was all lattice artifacts.
Yeah, so this is proof that it's not. I'm now going to show you something interesting. Okay. So now, all I'm going to do, I'm still not going to put full fluctuations in, but I'm going to use a thin wall approximation instead of an exact bounce. Okay? So instead of the blue line, I'm going to use the red dot. All right? So you can kind of see there's a little bit of a difference, but not very much. Okay? And this is the explicit profile I'm using when I say thin wall. So there are different ways you could do this. I'm not solving exactly for the vacuum, so this doesn't quite interpolate between the two minima T1. You could improve it by doing that. All right? And so this is, if you were to go evaluate, are these things actually solutions to the bounce equation? So this is the one that I was using before, so the numerical one. This red line is the one that I put in now. So okay, maximum violation is like 1%. Okay. And if you want, you can think of this as you're breaking the boost invariance of the initial solution. Okay. So I'm just going to run exactly the same thing, and I'm going to let it go for a while. And it starts out looking exactly the same. Except, okay, that does not look particularly boost invariant anymore, okay? So once again, I'm just going to plot the same plane. And you can see that this solution is no longer boost invariant when you add the time evolution. And the important thing you should notice in here, these ripples that are forming, they basically form on constant S surfaces, okay? So there's a very good reason why that happens that I will get to later. Okay. Now you can ask, would I have noticed that this was here if I had just assumed SO2-1 symmetry? And you can go do this, and you can run 1 plus 1 dimensional lattices where you assume exact symmetry, and you get this curve that is the red line, okay? And it basically follows what you would get had you used the exact instanton solution. So this is an effect that is completely missed unless you do not 3D, but more than one spatial dimension, okay? And again, I'll get to why that is. All right. So that was just the next step that you would take. The last one is I want to put in a full set of fluctuations, delta phi. So in general, you should go and solve for how the original fluctuations in the false vacuum get projected into the bubble spacetime. I did not do that, but I did run a lot of different initial conditions. What I'm about to show you does not depend on the choice, okay? So just to make it simple, I'm going to say, pretend that you were just sitting in the false vacuum on sub-horizon scales. This is what the field fluctuations would look like. Okay, so that's all I'm going to put. And this A and this B are just random numbers. Okay. So this is the standard way of doing classical random lattice simulations to do quantum field theory. And so now on the left here, I'm taking the same slices of the field, and I didn't put a uniform background expansion in. Okay. And you would expect that something interesting will happen, and so you wait for a while. And now you see that as well as the boost symmetry being broken, you've broken the rotational symmetry as well. Okay. And just as a demonstration that this does not depend on whether or not the background is expanding, so here I put in a background Hubble, and I'm just plotting contours of constant energy density. So you can see the bubbles starting to expand, and they're growing, and they're growing, and they're going to collide soon. Okay, so now they collide, and you can see this bouncing behavior happen. You're shooting out tori. Okay, and as this instability that you had grows, you can start to see this is looking less and less spherical. Sorry, less cylindrical. Okay, and eventually it dissolves and breaks up into these little blobs of energy. Okay. And these blobs sit there for a long, long time. So does anyone have a guess as to what those are? Someone might know. Yes. Okay. So this is a way to make oscillons with bubble collisions. And so these things have been explored before. Okay. They're usually explored in the context of some homogeneous mechanism for making them everywhere, as opposed to this, where you're just producing them in one very small plane. And so what these things are is they're little blobs of field that are held together by the field having an attractive force that's trying to collapse the thing, balancing out the dispersion from the Laplacian, which is trying to make the waves disperse away from this little blob you made. And so naively, you might think, well, they have lifetimes of order, whatever the mass scale is and the potential. Okay. not so clear, but this is almost up to 100. Okay, so these things will live for basically thousands of oscillation times, or more depending on the potential. Okay, and so this is a plot of the energy density, and this is a plot of the power spectrum. And what I've done is, instead of doing the 3D power spectrum, and it will become clear why I've done this later, I've just said I'm going to take my cube, I'm going to make slices of it. Okay, I'm now going to do 2D Fourier transforms on each of those slices and angle average the power spectrum. And then I get that as a function of slice, so a function of position. So this is just the position, the color scheme is the result of the Fourier transform, and this is the wave number. Okay. And again, I could wait here and let these go, but they live for a long, long time. Okay. Yeah.
So the potential that's supporting these oscillons is this quartic.
Yes. So on the one side where it's going back up to the other well, it's shallower than quadratic.
Yeah.
Which tells you there's an attractive force if you get up to that part of the potential.
Right. So is it the idea that they last as long as sort of their excursion is taking them up to the concave down part of the potential? And they,
yeah. It doesn't have to be concave down, but it has to be shallower than quadratic. So there's no exact statement that anyone has found about this is the necessary and sufficient condition. There's only some necessary conditions. So this one is around the true. You can make them oscillate around the false vacuum too. I've only done a very small number of collisions. You get lots of complicated stuff because it depends on the oscillation phase of this thing, what will happen. So as you're changing the oscillation phase, the relative oscillation phases, they come in, they could annihilate each other. They can temporarily trap each other and then eject themselves. They can merge into one. So lots of stuff can happen, and it depends on a lot of different things. The initial speeds, the initial separations, the relative phases. So I haven't done a really complete study of these things. Yes, yes, because the whole surrounding, so inside of the bubble is sitting in the true vacuum, and then the walls are sort of interpolating to the false vacuum, and then the walls fracture, and you're left with blobs where the field is sitting close to the false vacuum. Okay. And so if you take a blob that's close to the false vacuum, okay, so I did some more stuff. So that other one was a perfectly spherically symmetric blob that I started with the Gaussian profile. Now I'm just going to perturb it so that it's some ellipse. Okay, you can make all three of these different if you want, but this gives me one parameter instead of two. Okay. And this epsilon is just some parameter telling you how elliptic it is. Okay. And now I start these blobs and let them go. And so when you have and I've now measured the amount of energy in some sphere of some radius around that original blob. So if you have an oscillon, basically a little bit of energy goes out and then the rest gets stuck there. So you get this long plateau. And what's sort of interesting about this is, regardless of what the initial condition you started with was, you always go to the same energy, which is sort of suggesting that you will get the same oscillon at the end of the day. Okay, but the same oscillon. So you don't have a distribution of types of oscillons. But that's very circumstantial evidence from just looking at this graph. Okay. And there are also conditions where, yeah, the thing just disperses and nothing happens. All right. So that's what happens if you just take a double well and don't break the Z2 symmetry too badly. That's cool. That's awesome. Yay, we're going to do these in every single double well you could try. Okay. Now I'm going to try a different one. So I'm going to really badly break the symmetry. Okay, so I'm not in the thin wall regime anymore. And the field tunnels out far, far from the minimum. So it kind of tunnels out somewhere up here. And when I do this, there's no longer any noticeable breaking of the symmetry, unfortunately. Okay, so the reason this happens here, that you don't get any amplification, is if you were to look at this potential, the field sort of oscillates around here for the most part, and the potential is essentially quadratic in that regime. So there's nothing to drive the instabilities. Okay. And now you might also say, well, I'd like to get inflation in these bubbles. Okay. So if I were to do this with a single field, the obvious thing you would do is just say, okay, I tunnel out and there's some plateau. OK. Okay, and you can tilt the, you can change the slope of that plateau if you want. All right, and then you can run this. And as you might expect, nothing particularly interesting happens. Okay. So, yes. In this case, once again, what you get does not depend on whether or not you put in fluctuations or not. Okay. So here I'm just comparing simulations with and without fluctuations. And they basically agree perfectly well with each other. So it's a little disappointing that if you want to do one field is doing the tunneling and doing the inflation, well, the calculations that have been done in that case are correct, as far as I can tell. Okay. It's a little disappointing that you don't get something cool to look at on the sky.
Oh, but you do, and now it's even more predictive.
But I think it's important to keep in mind that when you talk about eternal inflation, you don't have one field. You have hundreds or thousands. Who knows? Not one. Okay, so if you say I'm allowed to add one extra field to my model, okay, what I can now do is say I have one direction associated with tunneling and then another direction that I'm going to slow roll on for inflation. Okay, so I'm just asking for one extra field. I'm not asking for 100 of them. Okay, and just schematically, this thing now has the form of, you know, a tunneling potential, an inflationary potential, and then some coupling. So by tuning this, you can basically get any inflation model you want. Okay. And so now you can go find what the instantons look like in this potential. Okay. And again, you get them into machine precision. An important point is the solution that I've plotted here only has one negative eigenmode in the O4 symmetric sector. It's a simple calculation to check for the other one. So it actually is something that describes vacuum tunneling. Okay. And so what happens is the red lines are just contours of that potential. So you start somewhere up here in the false vacuum. You basically tunnel, and then right at the end, you turn down the inflation direction. So if you were to think about what the single field, the effective single field, where I'm just going to define that to be the tunneling part and then the inflationary part, the potential you see is basically the well, and then a flat plateau, okay? Having said that, when you now consider collisions, okay, it is not a single field model anymore. So first of all, this is the evolution for the tunneling direction, okay? And so it does what you probably would expect, which is it does what the single field model with the double well did, okay? You break all the symmetries, okay? And now the interesting thing is what happens when you go look at the phi field, okay? So phi is supposed to be our inflaton, okay? So we're supposed to tunnel out, and then we roll this direction, which is phi, okay? And so you can see the field rolling down the plateau inside the bubble, okay? And you wait a little while, okay? So it starts out more or less with the right cylindrical symmetry. But because that tunneling field is breaking up and forming oscillons, everywhere that you formed one of those oscillons, you tend to pull the field back up the potential, which is exactly the opposite of what happens in the single field model, where the field will move down the potential. And while you're doing that, you also create a lot of inhomogeneity. You can get inflation, and you can get oscillons. And
what's the amplitude of the fluctuations?
So here, I took them, so the lambda parameter in front is controlling it. I took lambda 10 to the minus 6.
So these are sort of order 1 density perturbations?
So delta phi over phi naught was 10 to the minus 3 initially. So not huge. Again, that's just so this happened before the bubbles start hitting the boundaries. If you run with smaller perturbations and you study smaller initial fluctuations, you can see that they're growing. It's just you stop trusting your solution before you see them really go nonlinear. Okay. All right. So that was fun. Although it was all on a computer, and you may or may not believe me because, well, it's easy to write code that's not right. I would know. Okay. So there's a very simple way to think about what's going on and actually sort of get some sort of analytic handle on what's happening. Okay. So what we can do is say, all right, initially I started out with my actual field solution was some background that would have obeyed the SO2 unsymmetry, and then some perturbation that doesn't. Okay, and so you can ask, okay, the background obeys the equation I had before for the SO2-1 solution, and the perturbations obey some other equation, okay, where this kappa squared is an eigenvalue of the Laplacian on two hyperboloids. Okay, so roughly you should think of it as a wave number squared, okay? Now, again, just to make things a little bit simpler, let's go to the limit where S is big, consider timescales much shorter than S, and let's take that kappa squared parameter to be very big, okay? So in this limit, S is basically the size of the bubble. So you're saying I'm going to look at wavelengths that are much smaller than the size of the bubbles, so they're approximately planar. Okay? And this is just to get some intuition as to what's happening. And when you do this, you can reduce the equation for the fluctuations to an equation for a planar domain wall. Sorry, interacting planar domain walls and then fluctuations around them. And so now you should think of this k perp as wave numbers along the planar wall. Okay? And the only place that the background enters into this equation is through this V double prime, evaluated on the background solution, okay? So it's basically just a 1D wave equation with a time and space dependent effective mass, because the background is time and space dependent, okay? And so now, again, all we need. Okay, so again, I've relabeled variables and such. Okay. It's just we're going to the planar limit because the analysis is easier to do. Okay.
So V double prime is a function of S?
Yes, but I'm now identifying T and S as the same thing in the planar limit.
You are.
Yeah, so just think of two planar walls. If you make K.
Y and Z is small.
What?
You're saying Y and Z is small.
Yes, yeah. Yes. If you want, that's the way you can think about it. Yeah. Relative to S, there's. So again, all we need is V double prime. So remember that for the double well, we had some solution that looked like this. Okay. So you can see the wall sort of bouncing, and then you get a blob that's oscillating. When you do the planar case, you get something that looks very similar. Okay. You can sort of see bouncing walls. It just takes them a little bit longer to stop bouncing, and then there's some blob that oscillates here. And so if you look at V double prime, there are basically two regimes that you have. The one is there's one well here and one well up here. And those wells start out and they come together and they bounce off each other and they come together and they keep bouncing off of each other. Okay. And now all I'm going to do is take that top right plot and go to later times. Okay. And now at later times, instead of having two wells that keep bouncing off of each other, there's just one well that's oscillating up and down. So these are sort of two generic types of behaviors you can get. Okay? And so you have some oscillating background. It's not exactly periodic. But if it were exactly periodic, you could just use Floquet theory. So you think that probably this will give you some qualitative pictures to what's going on when you take the background to not be exactly periodic. And so in that case, you would expect solutions that sort of have this form, okay? Where this is some profile, and you can choose the profile to be real and periodic. T is the period of the background. And this mu is some complex number. Okay. So if mu has a positive real part, this describes growing fluctuations. And because we have a one-dimensional wave equation, there will be lots and lots of these mu's. I'm just going to worry about the one that has the largest real part. Because if we're looking for instabilities, this is the one that matters.
So if I reference the original picture of the potential, is this background the sigma field, or is it the phi field?
This would be the sigma field.
This would be the sigma
field. Yeah. So back to the double wall.
And then we're interested in finding the fluctuations in the other field, the photon phi field.
So actually, just in the sigma field. Okay. So the back reaction on the phi is essentially because sigma is doing interesting stuff. Okay. So if you want, when sigma goes back to the false vacuum minimum, there's really, really steep potential pulling phi backwards. Okay, so it's at some level just reacting to what sigma was doing. Okay. This is, again, just to understand why you have this breakup of the symmetry. Okay. All right. Again, I want to emphasize all we care about is V double prime, okay? And so the problem with using the double well is there are no analytic solutions for the background, okay? You can come up with some, but it's preferable to find a model where you actually have exactly periodic background solutions that look like two walls bouncing off of each other and a single oscillating blob. So the wonderful thing about the 1D Sine-Gordon model, which just has a potential that's negative cos phi, is there are exact periodic solutions that describe the bound state of a kink and an anti-kink. Okay, and these are called breathers. And so they have this form. Okay, this V is just some parameter that's controlling what the breather looks like. So if I take V to be very small, the V double prime that you get out has a wall and a wall, sorry, a well and a well, and they come together and bounce off of each other, and they keep doing this. Okay, so that's the first behavior we had. And if I instead take V to be like 1, okay, now I have a single well that's oscillating up and down. Okay, so that's the other qualitative behavior I have. And again, we're not going to get precise results by doing this, but it's going to give us a very good qualitative picture of what's happening. Okay, so now you can go do the full K analysis for this Sine-Gordon model, and this time it is exact. And this is the flow K chart you'll get. So the red colors are the largest real part of one of those flow K exponents. Okay? So the bigger this is, the more red, the stronger the instability is. Okay? This is just determining what the breather looks like. And you should think of this vertical axis as the perpendicular wave number squared times the period of the breather. Okay? So,
yeah.
This one?
Yeah.
Okay, so I really glossed over this. Okay. It turns out that if you have an equation of the form dv dt is equal to ut times v, where u is a periodic function, you evolve u from 0 to the period, okay? And then you look at u inverse 0 times u evaluated at the period. You get all the eigenvalues of that matrix. For every unique eigenvalue, you can find a solution of this form. Okay. So what I'm plotting is, okay, it's a field, so I have a really big matrix. I'm just saying I'm going to take that matrix and find the biggest positive version of it. Biggest eigenvalue that has modulus bigger than 1, okay? And then, of course, that has an eigenvector associated with it. Okay, that makes sense?
Yeah.
Okay. So yeah, the color is just plotting the value of that eigenvalue effectively. Log of the eigenvalue, but same thing. All right, so there are sort of two regimes we want to look at. Okay. And both of them are fairly easy to understand. So the first one is some generalization of broad parametric resonance, which everyone knows from Kaufman, Linde, and Starobinsky for the preheating literature. So the way you can think about this is the case where we have two wells, okay? So if I only had the one well, this is just talking about a single wall, okay? And so I started with the translation invariant theory, and then I spontaneously broke the translation invariance, okay, in the 1D theory. And so that means you have a Goldstone mode. Okay, and the Goldstone mode is just the derivative of whatever that background solution was. And it's a zero mode because it's a Goldstone. So that's in the 1D theory. So now I add these wave numbers that are along the plane of the wall. Okay, and they just describe ripples in the wall. Okay. And because I had this zero mode, all of those transverse things turn into basically massless fluctuations that have this dispersion relationship. What you have, if you had one well, you could just put fluctuations on it that are ripples in the wall, and they'll just flop back and forth, okay? So now I've added a second well, which will also have the same fluctuations on it, okay? And so for most of the evolution, these are good eigenstates. However, when the walls are interacting with each other, they are not good eigenstates for a very, very short period. And so you can think of, A, the frequency gets perturbed in a non-adiabatic way, as does the spatial structure of the eigenmodes, okay? And so what you would expect in that case is, if you were to plot some notion of what the effective mass is for the fluctuation sitting at the bottom of the well, which is this green line, okay? And you plot the value of the fluctuation evaluated minimum of the well, say, when they're not interacting, it just goes up and down and up and down. And then when they interact, there's this kick that will happen to it, and you expect a very sharp jump in the amplitude. And that's what you see here, okay? So what I've plotted is this green line is a scaled version of V double prime evaluated at the minimum of V. And this blue line is just the field evaluated at that point. So if you want, it's like asking, suppose I could do a dimensional reduction, what's the field doing in that dimensionally reduced bit? And because you understand where these things come from, there's a very simple notion of particle number you can define, although I hesitate to use the word particle number. Okay, there's an adiabatic invariant that is often associated with particle number, okay, which is the thing I'm plotting here. And you can see it's essentially constant, except when the walls hit each other. And it makes big jumps. Okay?
So each of these is the walls made up of what kind of
system? Yes. Yeah. So this is, you have the well, you have the other well, and they are crossing each other. And so for the Sine-Gordon model, they just basically disappear, and there ends up being no well at all. And then they reform. Yeah. And so those jumps are every time that they're basically overlapped. Okay. So that's a very simple case to understand. And again, all that it needs is that you have this zero mode associated with spontaneous breaking of translation symmetry. This is very, very general. Okay. Now, the other case is when you just have that one oscillating blob going up and down. Okay. In this case, the instability is much less violent. All right. You can, again, define some adiabatic invariant. It turns out that essentially all that happens is there's an oscillation that has the same frequency as that blob with an exponential envelope. And that's a pretty good approximation. You can go do an actual decomposition into various spectral pieces, and you'll see that the leading order component is the main one. Okay. And so again, this is just plotting that adiabatic invariant. You see it basically grows like a straight line with some wiggles that come from the higher harmonics. Okay. All right, so that was for the Sine-Gordon model. And just in case you don't believe me that this also happens in the double well, you can come up with various contrived approximations for the background. Okay. So all I'm saying is I found this is finding some approximation that describes two wells repeatedly bouncing off of each other. Okay. Now, the vertical axis is, again, just this maximal flow k exponent. And this is k perp t wells. Oh, and so one other thing I should mention. These oscillations that are bound to the walls have frequency k perp. The interactions happen every t. So this is just the phase that's accumulated between collisions, which is exactly what you would expect to be controlling the instability. Okay. So you can do that for the two walls. You can do this for an oscillating blob. Okay? Again, there's an instability band that you see. All right. And one other feature that the double well has that the Sine-Gordon model doesn't is that there's a mode that describes essentially the width of the wall vibrating back and forth. So this is a model-dependent statement. Okay. And so when you think about the well, it's a well whose width is just going back and forth. So you can also ask, do I pump fluctuations in that, and the answer is yes. Okay? So you can get these in the double well as well. Alright. And so now showing that this actually happens in a full lattice simulation, okay, now that we understand what should be happening. So on the left I'm plotting energy density contours, and this is the field. Okay. So you can see the walls bouncing off of each other, and you can see the absorbing boundary conditions basically taking all this planar radiation out of the cube. And as it starts oscillating up and down, you'll start to see ripples forming on the walls. Okay? And now you can start to see these ripples that are forming, which are, of course, the K-perp excitations. And eventually, everything goes nonlinear on you. Linear theory breaks down. You can't do the separation into planar and fluctuations. And when that happens, you once again make a bunch of oscillations. Okay? So this is just the planar version of what was happening with those bubble collisions. Okay? In a case where you sort of have a better way to go through the whole process in a rigorous way. Okay. All right. And so now this is why I was cutting that oscillon in the weird way before. So So again, this is the power spectrum, k squared times the power spectrum, for the two-wall system, where this time, because I have two planar walls, it makes sense to literally cut the cube up in planes parallel to those walls. Okay? And so as they're bouncing off of each other, you'll notice down here the fluctuations start to grow, and they're getting pumped. So here they're getting pumped because the wall width is oscillating, and they get pumped at every collision as well. Okay? So it takes a while for them to grow, and eventually all hell breaks loose, and you make little tubes, and everything goes crazy. Okay, now I'm just going to wait for a while. So one interesting thing that happens here is you can see this blob that's going along, and this will partially answer the question you had about interacting osmolons. At some point in that plane where the collision was happening, you had two blobs that hit each other and like scattered like this. Okay, and so now you have an osmolon propagating this way, and one propagating this way in order to conserve momentum. Okay, and so even if you ignore the fact that all the symmetries have been broken, you can ask, is this likely to have an effect on gravitational dynamics? And so what you want to know then is, what does the energy distribution look like? Okay, so again, this is for a planar simulation, but the bubbles will be similar. So if you would assume that you had perfect planar symmetry and run the simulation, you get this green line for the amount of energy in some slab around where the walls are colliding. Okay. And this is because when the walls break up and fracture, you release a whole bunch of energy as radiation. Okay? When you do the 3D simulation, instead, you see, yes, when the walls fracture, suddenly you lose a whole pile of energy going off into the bulk. Okay. All right. So now that you know this happens, it's obvious. Although it clearly was not so obvious until you actually went and ran simulations. Okay. So just a quick review of what's going on is, okay, we start with a state that is almost SO2-1 invariant, except there are small fluctuations. Okay, and then, obviously, depending on the background, those perturbations can be unstable, essentially because you have a time-dependent mass. Okay, and that instability, if you were to look at a planar wall or a bubble, it amounts to putting little ripples into the bubble walls. Okay, and eventually, those get big. And when they get big, what you have basically done is taken your field configuration becomes a bunch of blobs, where inside the blob, the field is sort of near the false vacuum. Okay, outside the blob, it's somewhere else. And so if you take such blobs and just let them go by themselves, you know that they make oscillons. Okay? And so this is then the nonlinearities of the field, condensing all these little blobs of field that you had into oscillon structures. Okay. And one nice thing is that you can actually make these in an inflationary model. Although, maybe it's not so nice because you might lose a little bit of predictivity. But it's still cool. Okay. All right. So now, this is, yes, very wild speculation. Okay. So what does this...
Speculate on observation. How what? Much energy do you dump into the oscillons?
So it's a power law decay. So it's not really well defined. But if you were to say, I have this much energy in the walls, and I want to qualify this with, I'm not taking really relativistic collisions. Okay. So if you were to have extremely relativistic. So the gamma factors of the wall, they're not going up to like hundreds or thousands. So then you have to resolve the whole wall in the simulation, which means you need a very small dx. So what I think happens there, I'll say why I'm not doing that. You also have to fit the whole bubble in the simulation. So you need a big box with a very small dx. That's extremely computationally painful. So these simulations were using like a billion to 10 billion lattice points. I mean, the ones that are 10 billion, which is a 2048 cube, take over a week to run. So it's not like you can just keep cranking the resolution up. So either you need to be much smarter about your boundary conditions, or else find some other way to do it. So when you take the extreme relativistic limit, the linear pumping is still going to happen. The question is that the wall dissolving still occur? So when the fluctuations become sufficiently large and then you run the walls into each other, you dissolve the walls in these cases. If the walls are moving really fast, that instability might not have time to develop. Okay? Having said that, when you do an actual bubble collision, even if the walls are very relativistic, they're losing energy each time they bounce. So eventually that gamma factor will come down. Okay, so eventually you'll get into the regime where gamma is not gigantic. Okay. It would be great to run like, oh, gamma is 1,000, but it's just not computationally feasible. That is another possibility. I would not. This is very true. Yes. This also would not surprise you. Okay. That you need gravity for, though.
Can you extract the anticipated gravitational wave signal from the lattice?
You can do it in the linear source approximation. So you solve box H equals Tij transverse traces. Yeah, because we have the whole energy. We have the whole stress energy transfer. So you can extract that and do that. I haven't done that calculation yet.
I'd be really interested to do
that. Yes, it would be. In fact, I have it in here somewhere. Yes, that would be very interesting to do, especially because as they're fracturing, you're making all kinds of gravity waves. It is very localized in time and space, though, so it's unclear what you would get from that. But that I am quite sure you could do just with linearized gravity as a good approximation. The thing that probably linearized gravity is a bad approximation for is getting the scale factor as a function of position, essentially. Or if you want the Hubble as a function. Okay, anyway, so the big thing is that when you get the observables on the sky, they do not have to have azimuthal symmetry, okay, because you're breaking all the symmetries that enforce that. Having said that, there is an issue of you're going to be doing some smoothing with the beam, physics is going to do smoothing, okay, so it's a question of how big is the scale of all this inhomogeneity versus the scale that the beam is working at, and yeah, you will make tensor modes when the walls fracture. I haven't done the calculation yet, but it is an interesting one to do. The energy density distribution is quite different. And so another thing is, if you look at delta ln A, and again, you need gravity to check this properly, but for the single field case, you push the field down the potential. For the two field case, you pull it up the potential. So presumably, delta ln A has different signs in those two cases. So that's the difference between a cold and a hot. Yeah, no, I read your paper.
No, but
oh, okay, cool. I would love to hear. Okay, and another thing is, nothing that I was doing here really relied on doing eternal inflation. So anytime you have some sort of first order phase transition, the same sort of thing is going to happen. And you know, specifically, you'll probably be making oscillons. So it's possible you could use these as some non-equilibrium environment for baryogenesis, although that is going to be very model dependent. Okay. These oscillons basically behave like cold dark matter, so you're going to perturb the equation of state from radiation. And of course, if you have some sort of brain world scenario where you're having walls collide with each other, okay, these instabilities are still there. So there might be some application of these kind of ideas to that case. Okay. All right. And now Dick told me to put in a really, really different slide in. So all these signals are going to be intermittent, and you should ask me about this afterwards. We have another way to make intermittent density perturbations, except from preheating. Okay. And there's a really cool way to understand what's going on. I just wanted to show you. You can think of preheating as saying there's the inflaton density perturbations. We have some other isocurvature field. Preheating takes that isocurvature field and makes density perturbations with some nonlinear function. And if you look at that FNL when you put it on the sky, you get stuff that can look very patchy and different depending on some parameters in the model. Okay? All right. And that's it.